Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we continue our week-long series on prisons in the United States. There are currently 2.3 million people behind bars. Since 1989, more than 2,000 people have been exonerated. Programs like the National Innocence Project, as well as lawyers and volunteers, work to help overturn wrongful convictions. After innocent people are released, they face serious challenges finding work, housing, and health care. Unlike parolees or other prisoners, there are often no formal release protocols for exonerees, and many have spent decades behind bars. In 17 states in the U.S., there are no laws compelling state governments to offer compensation for the years spent behind bars. And even in states that do offer compensation, it can be very difficult to obtain. When today's guest, Maurice Antoine Caldwell, was just 22 years old, he was convicted of murder, a crime he did not commit. He spent 20 years, 6 months, and 8 days in prison. The Innocence Project took up his case, and he was released on March 28, 2011. In 2012, he filed a claim for compensation from the state of California. That claim is still pending. A civil suit against the city of San Francisco is also pending. Today, Maurice Antoine Caldwell speaks to students and community groups about his experience, and he is the father of 2 children, and Maurice joins us in studio. 3 children. Sorry about that. 3 children. Maurice, thank you so much for coming in. I know you drove a long way to get here, so thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here.
It's an honor to have you. We're also joined in studio by Paige Kaneb, a supervising attorney at the Northern California Innocence Project at the Santa Clara University School of Law. Since starting at the Innocence Project in 2007, Paige has helped exonerate 9 men. Amazing. Hi, Paige. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And John Eldon is an attorney and director of After Innocence, an Oakland-based organization that offers exonerees help obtaining social, health, and legal services, and he also advocates for legal reform. And John also joins us in studio. Hi, John. Thank you for coming in.
Good morning. Great to be here.
It's great to have all of you. Maurice, I want to start off with you. I pay very close attention to the Innocence Project, and I feel like every week someone is being released from jail. Just last Wednesday, a court in Westmoreland County, Pennsylvania, vacated the 1991 rape conviction of John Kunko after he wrongly served 28 years in prison. What is it like for you to constantly hear about more and more people being released from prison?
It's to me, it's not sad, you know, because it's something that I know. I was in the system for almost 21 years, you know, and I met other people that, you know, procrastinate to be innocent to their crime, but not as innocent as I was to mine, because I represented mine to every day. You know, I was in the legal library. A lot of other people, you know, looked at the life in prison is what they focus more on than the time. Me, I was looking at, I didn't like the time every day in prison. So it's not surprising. It's just, I'm just blessed that awareness has been really, you know, focused now, you know, that this is happening. Mm-hmm. You know, this has been happening for a long time, you know. And to me, my awareness of the door opening was the OJ, when Barry Scheck and Robert Newfield started doing the DNA. You know, that's what started, you know, the floodgate. But I remember when I first went to prison in 1991, and I met this guy named Chance Powell, and they had a radio and TV show coming to prison, you know, and that's what I felt in my life, and in my case, that's what I needed was media. Hmm. You know, if I get the media attention and the public awareness of what happened to me, it'll make a change, you know. So as time went by, I got in touch with the Innocent Projects, and they became a project that just focuses on people that's actual innocent, and they look into them innocent areas, and the stuff that they reveal and they find as evidence of an innocence, they bring it out. They bring it to the forefront, you know, and that's an honor. And, you know, it's just hurtful, to me that it takes so long.
Mm. You know? Let's talk a little bit about your case. You were convicted in San Francisco of murder when you were just 22 years old. There was no physical evidence linking you to the crime. You were convicted on faulty testimony from an eyewitness who could not have seen you at the scene of the crime. And two other suspects gave a sworn testimony that they were the perpetrators and you were not involved. You sent a letter to the Innocence Project when you were in prison. How did you learn about the Innocence Project?
Okay, see, it was like when a person, like, in prison, you're fighting your case, it's like all the knowledge that you could, you know, sponge up and accept and you know, about society, about people trying to help people in my predicament. I started writing to, like, lawyers. When I first went to prison, my thing was writing to lawyers. Dateline, 60 Minutes, 2020, hard copy. How do you say Oprah Winfrey? You know, the people that I used to see on TV and the stories I used to see, I write to them, you know what I'm saying? And I tell them about my case that I'm innocent, you know, and all they need to do is contact certain people and they start seeing. So when I finally, as years went by and I had no response from, you know, these people, I might send them like, I say 60 or 50 letters within like 6 months. I write one letter and they tell you I copy it, you know, and then I just put names on it. I go through a phone book from the library, a legal phone book, and I just open it to the legal lawyers, and I get their address and I just send random letters, you know what I'm saying? Or you may come to prison and tell me who's a good lawyer from your city, you know, and I might look his address up and just write him a random letter, you know, hoping that they're, you know, I was one of the person like to say cry wolf. I was in there, you know, always hollering and trying to be heard. And as time went by, me doing a study in the library, a person said they got an innocent project. You know what I'm saying? And this innocent project was for public defender in San Francisco. They office became the San Francisco Public Defender Office started handling innocent cases. You know, people that write to the a public defender office and say I'm innocent, so they had lawyers. So that's where I first got in contact. No, that's, I apologize, that's the second time. I followed the same route that the guy Chance Powell, when I went to prison in 91, I got in contact with the Innocent Project in New Jersey, named Jim McCloskey. That's the person I first wrote. And then from there, they told me about people, and I should research Innocent Projects up north. So that's when I found the public defender. From the public defender Innocent Project, they shut down, and I was referred to the Santa Clara Innocent Project, and that's when my case got discovered.
A San Francisco public defender also wrote a letter saying that he believed you were innocent. And, Paige, there's a video that the Innocence Project put together about Maurice, and in that video, Linda Starr, legal director for the Northern California Innocence Project, said that the real difficulty in advancing Maurice's case is that the state of California did not respond. She said, quote, "I still don't understand why. Maybe they just don't want to deal with the truth."
Yeah.
I mean, can you talk just about what happens and how difficult it is to actually get, I mean, we're talking about California here. California didn't respond. How common is that?
I think it's actually gotten less common in the last couple of years. I think more DA's offices have started integrity units and so have more of a system now. As you said, there are more and more people getting exonerated. Mm-hmm. And so as it becomes more common. But in Maurice's case, I think part of what Linda meant was when we actually started investigating and talking to people, it was amazing. I mean, everybody was like, oh, everybody knows Maurice is innocent. It's just, and, you know, everybody knows Merritt really did it. And we go talk to Merritt in prison, and he says, oh, yeah, describes the whole crime, describes who's out there. And everybody said Maurice wasn't there. And then we also found a whole bunch of people who talked about where Maurice was. So it was, getting the evidence actually wasn't that hard. But then we presented it to the court. The court ordered the DA's office to respond because the state has to have a chance to say, oh, we think he should remain in prison or not. And they just kept asking for extensions of time. And Maurice was incredibly patient. He would, like, make a joke every time I'd tell him they got another extension of time. He'd say, don't worry, Miss P, I got nothing but time. But the one time he expressed impatience was when his mom got sick. He said he wanted to get out in time to take care of her. And unfortunately, she passed away while they were getting these extensions of time. And it turned out that they went and talked to people who all agreed that Maurice was innocent. I mean, there was no reason we could tell that they just kept waiting. And then that they just kept fighting, you know. They never went and talked to the guy who confessed. They still have never admitted that Maurice is innocent. They've still never gone and talked to the person, even though he was identified in 1990 and then by more people now and confessed to the crime.
Well, and also, Maurice, the state of California offered you a deal. They said you could get out if you said you were guilty. All of the charges would be dropped if you said you were guilty and you refused to do it.
It's like what Paige was just saying, you know, Ford's. My case was clear. Everybody that's I'm from this area right here. It happened in Alamany Housing Project. I grew up down there. You know, my case, I tell people, wasn't just a fly-by-day case. It wasn't a fly-by-night case. It was a targeted case. I was targeted by one narcotic officer. You know, this narcotic officer named Kit Crenshaw, he terrorized the whole San Francisco community. You know, he was one of the persons, like I tell people, you seen the movie Training Day. This guy, he was the guy that felt like he controlled everything and within our society as well. And for that, I became a target from my environment, where I come from. You know, and he the one initially put me involved in this case, and he set me up to take this fall. You know, and it was because of prior engagements that me and him, interactions that me and him had, you know, that got me, okay. And moving forward, like they say, like Paige say, when I was in prison fighting my case and they brought all the evidence to the, you know, prosecutor and the city attorney and them, you know, to see if they'd be willing, you know, cooperate to help with my case, they were still, you know, turning a blind eye to the truth, you know. And so as we filed for our order to show cause, was it? Our writ, we did a writ of habeas corpus. So doing a writ of habeas corpus, you know, one side got a certain amount of time to produce they paperwork, and then the other side got enough time, should have a reasonable time to respond, okay? These city officials was just deliberately, with malice, you know what I'm saying, you know, not responding the way they were supposed to respond and accordingly, and it was like they had, I think, what, 8, 9 stenches?
Yeah, I mean, eventually the court actually said that their delays were egregious and possibly deserving of sanctions and put the great line in that justice delayed is often justice denied, which, you know, Maurice really was denied justice for over 20 years and still continues to be denied full justice because he hasn't been compensated in any way.
And this is my thing when they say, when I came and I did all this time in prison, you know, it was for a crime I didn't do. You know, and the family that I had in my life, I lost, you know, the family that stayed with me for 20-some years or until they passed off, all of them passed away. You know, when it was my mother, my grandmother, my brother, and my auntie, these were the people that was there for me. The people, like, every week, every other week used to come see me, and these people used to cry. We used to cry together, like, you know, I didn't do this, you know what I'm saying? And if I didn't do it, you know, my grandmother, she was a God-fearing lady, you know what I'm saying? She would sit up in there and tell me, you know, just pray on it, you know. The truth will set you free, you know. And I grew up like that, you know. Like, you know, I grew up with, like they say, old school, you know, things. With that, the Tony Beretta, you know, is that the name? Tony Beretta, you know, don't do the crime if you can't do the time. I'm a true believer. If I'm wrong about something, I fully represent it. You know what I'm saying? I can accept my responsibility for that. So all these people, my family that stayed strong with me and believed in me that passed away, and my mother was the last one when I finally came back to the county. You know, it was an insult to get at me like that. You know, for all these people that have faith in me, and for y'all to come ask me to give y'all something that I would never give you. I wouldn't even tell the board. You know, I used to go to board in prison, like they
the
like every
board.
4 or 5 years. You know, consider. And when they see me, they hear tapes from other prior board. You know, me coming in there, And my story used to always be the same, you know. I feel bad that somebody passed away, but I can't accept the responsibility that I did it. And that's not what the board want to hear. Mm. They want to hear you come in there. And for all the years I've been doing, you know, and my program has been good, you know, in prison. I have been, a person they call A1A. I did program, and that was only due to the fact that I wanted to be entitled to go to the library, you know, be entitled to my visits, you know, not be deprived of, you know, something that meant more to me than anything in prison, you know. So it's like throughout my years, after me coming back, they had the audacity to ask me or try to ask me, will I take a deal? You know what I'm saying? I've been told Paige from day one, I would never take, you know what I'm saying? Never in my life, you know, even consider, you know. And like I told, you know, the joke.
Murray said, like, every lawyer around telling him, you know, look, you can go back to prison. You risk going back to the prison for the rest of your life because there's no guarantee about what a jury will do. And obviously the jury failed to do the right thing the first time, even though they didn't get all the evidence. Everybody was saying, like, obviously I would take the deal. I told them I had no idea what I'd do in his shoes. But Maurice, like, never wavered at all on this, even though the attorney's his trial attorney made him think about it for 3 days before actually giving a response. But then Maurice answered,
"They wanted me to take this into serious consideration. This case is a long case. You know what I'm saying?" And I told him when they came in the holding tank, and they was like, "Well, Maurice, you know, you just consider it, you know." So when I had time, you know, that the time they gave me to consider it, I called my family. You know, my sister, you know, the last one I got here, you know, I told her, and her husband, my brother-in-law, I told them, and they was like, you know, you ain't never said you go take nothing, man. You know, I always told them I would never, because it was people in prison, not just when I came home. It was other legal beagle prisoners in prison say, "Maurice, let me tell you something, man. When you, if you happen to get cases, the more cases they get back, the most thing they do, they reduce time. Instead of letting a person out, they reduce time or offer you a deal." I was like, "Well, I'm going to trial, because they're not going to do what they did to me at the first trial for this trial. Hmm. I'm not going to sit and allow it, you know." And like I tell a person, this not no fly by night. I was targeted. So for that targeted, I'm not going to just let this officer and me just stick with this me sitting in prison. I wasn't going to go for it.
Maurice Antoine Caldwell was 22 when he was convicted of murder in San Francisco, a crime he did not commit. He spent 20 years, 6 months, and 8 days in prison. He was released on March 28th, 2011, and he filed a claim for compensation from the state of California. It's still pending. Today, we're also joined by Paige Caineb, supervising attorney at the Northern California Innocence Project at the Santa Clara University School of Law. Since starting there in 2007, she has helped exonerate 9 men. And John Eldon is an attorney and director of After Innocence, an Oakland, California-based organization that offers exonerees help obtaining social, health, and legal services. And on today's Your Call, we are continuing our week-long series on prisons in the United States. Today, we are talking about what society owes exonerees. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. John, before we talk about how you work and help exonerees, what are your overall thoughts about where we are right now? Because it does feel like so many more people are getting out of prison.
I think that we're at a moment of opportunity because we've seen so many people get out in the recent years. Opportunity because generally toward criminal justice reform, there's far more attention being paid in the press and hopefully by politicians and people committed to serious reform. But it's an opportunity. It isn't done. And it remains to be seen whether we'll take this moment and achieve true reform in criminal justice generally and also on behalf of the wrongfully convicted. And that would, of course, include how we respond to wrongfully convicted, wrongful conviction cases and how we make amends as best possible with the people who've paid such a terrible price for these systemic errors. And the other thing I'd say about where we are right now is a good long way from accountability. accountability that we owe them, but we also owe ourselves. This is a prison system. In California, we spend over $10 billion a year. It's not a small part of our budget. It's not a small part of what we do. And in every one of those cases, it is the people of California in whose name these convictions take place. It's a serious business. And we owe ourselves a system that is accountable for error. Take a look at the legal system. It's built with the understanding that there will be errors. That's why there are appellate courts. And yet, we seem unable in certain places to really take that seriously and say that if there is going to be error, and error of all types, errors that are have to do with intentional bad actors, tragic errors of just people getting it wrong, well-meaning, all across the spectrum, we're going to find errors. And a measure of our seriousness, our integrity, and our justice is how we respond when we find those errors, as well as the things we do to seek out those cases and also the reforms necessary to reduce them from occurring to the extent possible. We should never stop trying to reduce error, but never also should we conclude that we're going to finish that process. Mm. And so no matter how far we get on this road, we still have to answer the question, what do we owe Maurice Caldwell? What is the right thing to do? And I think anyone looking at how we've responded as a society, California and other states as well, would see that we've got a long way to go.
We have a long way to go. Just recently, over 20 death row exonerees were in Phoenix for the Witness to Innocence annual gathering. Since 1973, 162 people on death row have been found innocent and released. And a number of these men said, this is one of the main reasons why we need to overturn the death penalty, because they were on death row and now they are out. And I also wanted to ask you, I mean, when you hear stories about people getting out of prison, you know, you have to wonder how many people are in prison right now who are innocent. Is there any way of knowing this based on the data that we have about people who've been exonerated?
I'm not an expert on sort of the predictive aspects of it. It's always going to be more than the ones that we know. Mm. It's also going to be more than the ones that are formally exonerated for the reasons we just heard Maurice talk about. You know, Maurice had an incredibly tough decision to make, and one where he took one side, which is to say, I'm never going to take a plea to something I didn't do. But there are many who do take a plea, not because they did it, but because they've been in for many, many years, because they don't trust that the system would come up with the right result. And so the numbers are always larger than we know in terms of those people who are in prison. The other number we should take seriously is that if you believe in wrongful conviction, and everyone should, and that there are people in prison for crimes that they did not commit, one of the very uncomfortable corollary beliefs must be that we will not find them all. And so we can estimate how many there are there, but there will always be people that will not come through. When we hear about these DNA cases, we should remember that there are many instances where the DNA evidence was thrown away, or where it has degraded to a point where there's no way to test it. Or there was none at all, which is the case in the vast majority of cases. These cases turn on incredible luck, bad luck sometimes, as well as malfeasance to begin with, but also incredible luck and the determination of lawyers who, like Paige and her colleagues around the country, who work many, many, many hours for many clients. And it's incredibly important to consider that we're not going to know the full extent of this, and that's part of the reason we have to keep fighting and keep trying.
Paige, what changes have you seen since you started at the Innocence Project in 2007 in terms of the letters that you receive from people behind bars saying that they're innocent? And can you keep up? I mean, how do you determine what cases to take?
It's a really tough process. And sort of what John was touching on, for me, the sort of most frustrating and or hard ones are the ones where you just can't figure it out one way or another. There wasn't much evidence of guilt to begin with. But there's also nothing new to find. Like, and sometimes that's the hardest in the cases where there's almost no evidence because there's no leads, right? The police never had a bunch of suspects. There's no physical evidence to do DNA testing on. So there's a lot of cases where we do investigation and we just, there's just nothing to tell us the answer one way or another. We look at lots of cases also where it does look like the system got it right and the people really should, were rightfully convicted. And then we have cases like Maurice's where you look at them and you're like, oh, this is so clear that he was wrongfully convicted. And sometimes somewhere in the, like, sometimes it's less clear, but once you dig in, the science, what looked like, you know, clear scientific proof that someone was guilty turns out to all be faulty. So sometimes it takes longer to figure out what the answer is, but it's really hard to keep up. And we've seen, I mean, we've also, we're down on funding. I mean, one of the things we've seen through having, you know, there's lots more funding now going to people who are directly fighting against policies put in place, for instance, by the Trump administration. So there is like a limited pool of funds that go to nonprofits that are currently being focused elsewhere. Not that there isn't also a need there, but it does make it hard in terms of being able to keep up with all the cases.
Mm. Paige Canab is supervising attorney at the Northern California Innocence Project. John Eldon is an attorney and director of After Innocence. And Maurice Antoine Caldwell was convicted of murder, a crime he did not commit when he was 22. He was released on March 28, 2011. And since 1989, more than 2,000 people in the United States have been exonerated. Today, we are talking about what society owes them. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will discuss media coverage of the private prison industry, how corporations are profiting from prisoners' labor, and prison reform. We will also talk about the 2001 drug decriminalization law in Portugal. Here in the U.S., nearly 48% of people in the federal prison system are in for drug crimes. It is very different in Portugal. Today, we are talking about what society owes exonerees. Since 1989, more than 2,000 innocent people have been released from prisons and jails. And we're joined today by Maurice Antoine Caldwell. He was convicted of murder when he was just 22. This is a crime he did not commit. He spent 20 years, 6 months, and 8 days in prison. The Innocence Project took up his case, and he was released on March 28, 2011. He filed a claim for compensation in the state of California in 2012. That claim is still pending. A civil suit against the city of San Francisco is also still pending. We're also joined by Paige Canab, supervising attorney at the Northern California Innocence Project at the Santa Clara University School of Law. Since she started there in 2007, Paige has helped exonerate 9 men. John Eldon is an attorney and director of After Innocence, an Oakland, California-based organization that offers exonerees help obtaining social, health, and legal services. And let's go to a caller. Let's hear from Carol in San Francisco. Hi, Carol. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead. You're on the air.
I wanted to mention something that your speakers talked about, the length of time it took for the state to respond to Maurice's case. It's so egregious. And I wanted to point to the situation of Kevin Cooper, who's an innocent man on death row in San Quentin. He's been there 35 years. He's exhausted his appeals, although he's incontrovertibly innocent, but his lawyers have submitted a petition to the governor to test the evidence in his case, and it's almost 2.5 years since they submitted the petition to the governor, and he has not responded. We're finally getting some response because Nicholas Kristof wrote a big article in the New York Times mm-hmm. about Kevin's case.
Yes, I read this piece, and it's getting a lot of attention. Kristof pointed out that Jerry Brown and Kamala Harris, the state attorney general before becoming a U.S. senator, refused to allow newly available DNA testing. And she, I believe, went on Twitter recently and said she now supports DNA testing. What happens, Paige, when a politician changes his or her mind on this?
I mean, unfortunately, when she was the attorney general, if she had changed her mind, it actually would have been legally effective. Like, then he could have actually gotten DNA testing. For her to tweet it now is not quite this. It doesn't have the same effect. She was also, I thought Nicholas Kristof, his point that these sort of what we think of as good liberal, good Democrats have sort of failed here. She was also the district attorney in San Francisco when the office didn't respond in Maurice's case. So it would, I like Ms. Harris's politics. It would be nice to see her act on them when she has the power to do so.
I think this illustrates an important tension, right, in terms of the openness to the inquiry. And I think that we across the political spectrum, can agree that we don't want people in prison who didn't do it and who have ways to show that. And I think that it's not the first time we've seen a resistance on the part of even progressives in the seats of power to deal with this issue. And why that is, I'm not sure. Maybe they're afraid of floodgates or political repercussions, but the overriding issue here should be justice and fairness. And, you know, I think there's a growing movement to see prosecutors grab hold of the idea that their value and achievement is going to be measured by getting the right answer, not just getting convictions. And I don't want to paint prosecutors with a broad brush, but I don't think you need to do that to say that we have a long way to go. And also as a public, you know, they are responding in many instances elected to a public that I think can be said sometimes demands that there be a culprit.
Yep.
And doesn't reinforce the idea that sometimes there won't be or sometimes the right call may be politically unpopular. And we need to make clear to our leaders that our priorities are on justice.
Well, we should also point out that Kevin Cooper is black, and Nicholas Kristof wrote that Kamala Harris and Jerry Brown refused to allow newly available DNA testing for a black man convicted of hacking to death a beautiful white family and a young neighbor.
So. Yes, I read the article and I don't know a lot about that case. But you've introduced the subject of race, which unsurprisingly plays right through wrongful convictions.
Right.
Our statistics show that African Americans make up about 13%. I might be off by a couple of points of the national population, and 36 or three times that of the prison population. When it comes to the exoneree population, it's even higher. 46%, I think, is the current number roughly on the National Registry of Exonerations, which is the a very important resource that identifies exonerees by an academic criteria. It's maintained by the University of California, Irvine. And that's a great place for listeners and anyone interested in this issue to learn a lot about exonerations. And Maurice's story is there, as are the stories of 2,223 other exonerees since 1989. And it's an incredibly important resource and a sobering one that talks about, in addition to individual cases, the trends and statistics that we're seeing as we wake up to exonerations. But one of the things about it is we don't know what we don't know. And the where exonerations take place depends in many instances on where there are lawyers like Paige and her colleagues working. And there is not an even deployment of resources across the innocence world. There is also not an even deployment of resources within prosecutors' offices across the country. And one of the things that I'm struck by is how we are all used to hearing the Innocence Project or an innocence organization doing the hard work and getting the result. But I think one could wonder, why is it with our tax dollars going to a justice system, we are depending on nonprofits that have to raise money in order to find cases like Maurice's case and then fight that fight? Mm-hmm. With my tax dollar, I'd like in my $10 billion California corrections system a fair amount of money allocated to a reasonable level of resources spent looking for these cases from the inside as well. And I think any good system tries to seek out instances where it got it wrong. We have internal affairs divisions within police departments. I think that the idea of a conviction integrity unit that meets real standards is an obvious thing we want to see in most places. And yet, I think the current statistics are that we have CIUs, as they're called, in just 1% of the district attorney's offices in the United States.
1%?
I believe so. And if not, it's pretty low, and it should be higher.
Wow.
And I think that John made a really important point about the search for truth. And one of the places that's really frustrating is when this, like, there can be times when we see the meaning of evidence differently. But when the state opposes DNA testing or turning over evidence so that we can look through it, and you can't even, they oppose basically the search for the truth in and of itself, that is, I think, the hardest. That's where I don't see what the justification is. Like, I wanted DNA testing on a gun used in a shooting, and it was opposed by the DA's office. We had to litigate in that county. So that, I think that's a place where we could all come together and say, at the very least, we should be testing the evidence relevant to the crime, and the state has no business opposing DNA testing in cases like Kevin Cooper's or any other case where the evidence that someone wants to test is relevant to, could show who the perpetrator really is.
Does the Innocence Project receive any government funding at all?
Yeah, so each of us are separately funded, each project. So our project has received grants, for instance, for DNA testing from the Department of Justice. But even with that grant, because the state has the access to the evidence, that doesn't allow us to DNA test. It just gives us money to DNA test if we're allowed to get access to the evidence, which often has to be court-ordered if the state doesn't agree.
Mm. Excuse me, can I interject on
Please. The
statement that they spoke on about Kamala Harris and Jerry Brown, about the Kevin Cooper and all that? I was wrongfully convicted, so I'm going to speak from a biased perspective. I'm not going to speak, you know, as them. You know, I feel like Kamala Harris, Jim Brown, they played a part, you know, that they political people, but now to me and to Kevin Cooper and people like Kevin Cooper and wrongfully, they political incorrect. You know what I'm saying? And then when it's time for accountability to be held, the only accountability that it could really fall on is these state officials, the district attorneys. You know what I'm saying? That wrongfully convict us and do everything they can to send us to prison for a crime we didn't commit. Now when it's time to unwind that, it's like it's a ladder. Like, everybody that was involved will have be held accountable. So these state officials that look at that, that's their support. That's the support system. You know what I'm saying? The police system, the CCPOA, you know, they support people like Kamala Harris and them and Jerry Brown that's tough on crime and all this. You know what I'm saying? But they don't never consider the victims of this. They look at one side as victims. That's all district attorneys. When they went to school, when they come up, they look at one side. You know, it's a victim side and just a perpetrator side. And they look at the people that get defended, you know, by lawyers and all that. You know, they defending the perpetrator. They defending it may be many guilty people that a public defender, I mean, or a lawyer must defend because that's their job. And then for a state official, it's a district attorney job to, convict. To file charges. You know
what
I'm saying?
Their job is to search for the truth.
But that's what that's where
we demand that they do that.
But that's where it falls short at in the system. Mm. The truth. You know what I'm saying? The lawyers may put out the truth. I'm gonna tell my lawyer I didn't do this. You know what I'm saying? I was such I didn't do this. My lawyer gonna speak that to within the justice system and the court, and the district attorney is gonna turn it around, manipulate that. You know what I'm saying? Like, everybody that the witnesses that came to speak and say Maurice Twine didn't do this crime. It was such and such. And they from my neighborhood. They from where I grew up at. The district attorney said, you're only on the stand to say it wasn't Maurice Caldwell Twine because you're scared of him or you know him or you're doing a favor. You know what I'm saying? But a lady that they used against me on a wrongful conviction, they didn't use that. They didn't put her in no category as that. They used her as the upstanding this person. You know, she did a heroic thing or whatnot. She came forward in the midst of a ghetto and pointed the finger out at somebody. So this lady must be pushed forward and pushed to the moon. you know, without no consideration that I'm a victim. Me and my family's going to be victimized, but they looking at the opportunity that they getting. And like I say, political.
In Maurice's case, it should have been really obvious because there was just this one witness. She was Maurice's next-door neighbor. Her first statement to police was, the shooters don't live around here. I don't know their names or nicknames. They ask if anyone else saw. She says, maybe the person next door. So now she's also said he's likely a witness. And then they bring him up to her front door. She still doesn't say that's the shooter. And then they come back with a photo lineup with Maurice in it, tell her they'll move her out of the projects if she cooperates. Only then does she identify him. And they never say, and she says, I know him by his nickname, Tuan. He lives next door to me. And they don't say, well, why last time did you say they're not from around here? You don't know his name. They just say, oh, you've identified the suspect, Maurice Caldwell. He's the one with the shotgun. And off they go and convict him. So, I mean, in his case, it really should have been. I mean, I think there are cases where there are lots of cases where it's innocently done. No one should have known. We bring the evidence forward. The DA's office is like, oh, we made a mistake. We're sorry. And that's how it should go. But Maurice's is sadly not one of those examples.
And it's wrong because you got court. Once you get wrongfully convicted, you got appeal process. Once you go through the lower court's appeal process, they just rule in favor of the court that convicted you. You know what I'm saying? They don't never...
Well, they're looking at the same record. So in Maurice's case, where most of the evidence never came out, both because he had a bad attorney and the district attorney wasn't interested in the truth.
So in prison, when you're in prison, it's like all the years I fought in prison, it's like steps you got to go through before you get a real remedy. And in prison, they say the only... And when a person fighting their case, they say the only way you're going to get relief is if you get in the federal courts. You know what I'm saying? The state and the Supreme Courts... They're not going to give you remedy. But once you get to the federal courts, then they go do it. So it's like...
But we won his case in state court.
Yeah. You know what I'm saying? But a lot of cases got to get past, like, years in prison. You know what I'm saying? Like, many years. And it's like they say, it's fast to get in, but the wheels to come out is even worse. It's too long.
Well, and one of the things, like, we expect... So in order to reverse your conviction, if you have a bad attorney, you have to show that a good attorney would have done things differently and that those things would have made a difference. So someone like Maurice from prison with no money, no lawyer, no investigator is supposed to do all the things his attorney didn't do in order to show that they would have mattered. So part of the reason it takes so long is until a lawyer on the outside actually picks up the case to do the things the attorney didn't do in the first place, there's really no way for him to do what our system expects, which is to go talk to all the witnesses the lawyer didn't talk to, get statements from them, and show that they would have mattered at trial.
Paige Kaneb is supervising attorney at the Northern California Innocence Project. Since starting there in 2007, she has helped exonerate 9 men. John Eldon is an attorney and director of After Innocence, an Oakland, California-based organization that offers exonerees help obtaining social health and legal services. And Maurice Antoine Caldwell speaks to students and community groups about his experience. He was convicted of murder, a crime he did not commit, when he was just 22 years old. He spent 20 years, 6 months, and 8 days in prison. He was released on March 28, 2011. Today, we are talking about what society owes people like Maurice. Let's hear next from Dory in San Francisco. Hi, Dory. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Rose. The guests should know I have a radio program on KALW. There's a segment within it called Gaza Corner, and I received a letter about 3 years ago from a San Quentin inmate on death row named James P. Anderson. And he was struck by a segment that talked about the oppression of Palestinians and the injustices done to Palestinians, which he related to. And then he tried to, you know, he sent me a lot of letters and tried to have me be also a voice for his plight, which has been taken up by a number of people, including a guy named Lewis Wolf. But apparently he's still on death row. There appears to be overwhelming evidence that he was wrongfully convicted. And although this isn't exactly related to what you're talking about on the show, I'm just wondering, do any of your guests know about James P. Anderson? And evidently the difficulty to getting a retrial, even though there's overwhelming evidence in his conviction. And he's been in prison... he's now 65 years old, and I think he was in prison possibly. I have a chart here that I just looked up online. James P. Anderson, age of offense 26. He's now 65.
Wow.
And sentencing date was November 30th, 1979.
Wow. Do you know about this case?
I don't.
I also don't. We don't usually do death penalty work because they're the only people who have lawyers post-conviction. Mm. And so because they're the only people who the state actually pays for lawyers for, we don't want to interfere with that. And also because we have such limited resources, we focus on people who no longer have a right to a lawyer. But John is right that some of our taxpayer dollars should go to funding lawyers who look for errors, not just in death penalty cases, but in all cases. But
yeah,
I have
an unusual sort of role in the innocence world. Mm-hmm. I spend almost all my time speaking directly with people who've been wrongfully convicted. To date, more than 500 of them across 47 states. But I don't do any exonerating work. I don't get anyone out of prison. I have no expertise in criminal law. My background is as a civil litigator and by now somebody who's really just spent a ton of time working one-on-one on the phone with exonerees all across the country in a few different areas. So I'm the wrong person to ask about, you know, specific cases because it's just not an area that I work much in. But the reason I do the work that I do is because as much attention as there has been in the innocence world and in the country to wrongful incarceration and getting people out and preventing them in the future through policy reforms, there's been a relatively small amount of attention paid, especially over the long term, to what it's like for these people after they get out. Mm-hmm. And so I decided to focus exclusively on that issue for this population.
Well, let's talk about that. And Dory, thank you for calling. That's Dory Stein, the host of Tangents on KALW. Maybe we should do a show specifically about people on death row who say that they are innocent. Thank you for calling. Let's talk about what people face when they get out of prison. If you've worked with 500 people in 47 states, so almost the entire country, what state would you say is doing the most for people who have gotten out of prison?
Putting me on the spot. There are certainly some states that, in terms of when you say doing the most, I think we need to think about what does that look like? And maybe it's compensation.
Tennis.
And in terms of which states provide what we would call more toward meaningful compensation than
Tennis.
Not. And we've heard Texas a couple
Texas.
Times mentioned. Texas is known among the exoneree population because there is a very, in some ways, very forward-thinking compensation scheme in Texas. And because Texas is a large state and there are many exonerees there, there are a lot of exonerees in the exoneree population who've been the beneficiaries of that statute. And we can talk a little bit more in detail if there's time about that one. There are some other states that, for the compensation statutes that they have, meet some of the decency requirements. That would be wide availability, not restricting it to certain kinds of cases, fair process, and certainly the amount of money that's given, something more than paltry. And I can say a little bit about sort of what the national scheme looks like. You mentioned at the top of the show that 17 states offer you nothing. In more than 10 years of doing this work and 3.5 full-time, I'm always getting the question, people saying, surely they must. And the end of that sentence is, be entitled to something from the state. And the answer is that in 17 states, it does not matter how innocent you are, how much you could prove. There is simply no entitlement to anything. The entitlement comes when the legislature creates a compensation statute. And we have statutes in the rest of the states, right, and the District of Columbia and at the federal level. But if you look into those statutes, it doesn't take very long to see that along the lines of what I mentioned a minute ago, the decency criteria, a substantial number, even half of them, don't meet it. Either the compensation is paltry. We call Montana a compensating state when all they make available is free tuition at a state university, no money. States like the often cited Wisconsin remains with a monetary offering from many, many decades ago. You're entitled to $5,000 a year, which is capped at $25,000. Paige is laughing because it's funny, and it's also
awful.
It's awful. There are states like Missouri, I believe, has a requirement for DNA proof in the for the exoneree. And so what you get there is compensating people who got out on DNA evidence, but not people who didn't. And I could go on and on and on. We have a long way to go in figuring in seeing a majority of states adopting reasonable compensation statutes. And if I can just take another minute to mention very quickly, a lot of people understandably are confused about civil lawsuits. And Maurice has both a compensation claim in California and a civil lawsuit. The most important thing to remember about a civil lawsuit is you must prove official misconduct, wrongdoing, and also prosecutors are, for the most part, immune. Yeah. And when you take that into consideration and you look at exonerations, you see that the majority, the great majority of exonerees to begin with, never had a civil suit either. So people are often saying, why can't they just sue and get millions, as so many do for wrongdoing by the government? The answer is, and it's really important to mention, it isn't even an option for the great majority of exonerations, exoneree cases. And as Maurice has demonstrated, his case shows, it can take an incredible amount of time and effort and energy to finally get something for those who do have those claims.
In California, exonerees are entitled to $140 per day of wrongful incarceration. With more than 20 years in prison, Maurice, that means you're entitled to more than $1 million. Just quickly, what resources did you get when you got out?
Like John said, John is one of the guardian angels for exonerees. You know, when we need to go somewhere, we need information, or we need, you know, immediate attention, we get referred to John, you know, and he have helped me.
What did the state give you?
Oh, the state didn't give me nothing. They just allowed me to go through the door, you know, but they never gave me nothing, not a bus token, not a go phone, not no sense of direction, nothing, after 20-some years of being incarcerated. That's wrong.
Why is his claim for compensation, just quickly, still pending, Paige?
Because right now the process is crazy and requires a lot more litigation, and that's something we're trying to fix with a bill that's up right now, SB 1094, which we would love public support for. But the process really right now is really broken. Many exonerees don't get compensated, and the ones who do, it does take years.
You got the city officials, the city attorney, and them, they still denying accountability. They refuse.
And this is in the city of San Francisco and the state of California.
Yes.
Maurice Antoine Caldwell speaks to students and community groups about his experience. He spent 20 years, 6 months, and 4 days in prison. He was convicted of murder, a crime he did not commit when he was just 22. He was released on March 28, 2011. Paige Kaneb is supervising attorney at the Northern California Innocence Project. Since she started there in 2007, she has helped exonerate 9 men. John Eldon is an attorney and director of After Innocence, an Oakland, California-based organization that offers exonerees help obtaining social, health, and legal services. Maurice, Paige, and John, thank you all so much for coming in. Thank you for your work,
thank
Paige
you.
And John. And Maurice, thank you. I know you've told your story so many times, but thank you for driving here a long distance to tell it again.
Thank you for having me. Can I just say something in closing? I just want to say, you know, like with the state didn't do anything for me. You know what I'm saying? We got groups like Exonerated Nation and people like John Eldon's group. You know, Exonerated Nation was funded by O.B. Anthony, and he helped a lot of exonerees, you know, stay focused out here. So I just want to say people get involved with Exonerated Nation as well.
All right. We'll continue to follow this. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.
Thank you.